This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
So with that, I'm going to hand it over to our speaker.
Oh, thank you. And trying to catch my breath because I was kind of lost trying to find this place. And thank you, all of you.
It took me a second, too.
Yeah, thank you, all of you, for being here. I know there are other very interesting presentations going on at the same time, so I really appreciate your presence. As the introduction indicated, I'm going to be talking about the situation in Puerto Rico, and needless to say, I can only go into broad strokes about the situation. I'm going to speak, I hope, during 30 minutes, maybe, and then I can go into more detail about any aspects that you want to discuss. I am going to, there's basically eight points that I want to make. They are indicated in the handout I gave you. First of all, I begin with a little bit of background and general description of the situation of Puerto Rico. As probably all of you know, Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States, has been a colony of the United States since 1898, since the Spanish-American War. And when we speak about colonialism, we normally concentrate on the political aspects, the fact that we are politically dominated by the United States. I'm not going to go into the details of that. We can discuss that afterward if you want to talk about it. I'm going to talk more about the economic aspect of U.S. colonialism and its consequences. So the first page you have there in the handout basically indicates seven aspects of Puerto Rican society that have been constants since the United States came to control Puerto Rico. Of course, the Puerto Rican economy has evolved greatly from the early 20th century to the present. We used to be a sugar-producing country many years ago. Today, the main industry is the pharmaceutical industry, so it's very different. But at the same time, there are some things that have remained the same through all of these very important changes. And I enumerate them rapidly for you. They are there in the handout. First of all is that since the very earliest years of the 20th century, the main sectors of Puerto Rico's economy, not all sectors, but the main sectors of Puerto Rico's economy, the main productive sectors of Puerto Rico's economy, have been controlled by foreign corporations, basically U.S. corporations, whether it was the sugar industries in the early 20th century or the pharmaceutical industries today, the light manufacturing industries in between, they were basically owned by U.S. Corporations. Secondly, that has meant that Puerto Rico's economy has been specialized in a very one-sided way. At one point, we produced sugar, basically. And at other points, we were specialized in light manufacturing, as I said, garment, food processing, and so on. Today, we have a very significant capital-intensive sector, like the pharmaceuticals and so on. So we go from one specialization to another, which makes the economy very one-sided and also very vulnerable to whatever changes there are internationally in that sector in which we have been specialized. Third aspect of this arrangement is that a significant portion of the wealth produced in Puerto Rico, of the income produced in Puerto Rico, flows out of the island in the form of profits or dividends or interest payments and so on. So a very significant part of whatever wealth and income is produced in Puerto Rico is not reinvested in Puerto Rico, but rather leaves the island. And not being reinvested in Puerto Rico means that it doesn't generate growth or employment in Puerto Rico. So a fourth feature of Puerto Rican society through the century has been very significant or mass unemployment. What in the US would be considered mass unemployment, 15% unemployment, for example, is the normal situation in Puerto Rico. Very high unemployment, needless to say, makes it very difficult for workers to organize, makes workers compete for the very few jobs that are available, so it translates into low wages compared to the United States. You know, sometimes, even in order to promote investment in Puerto Rico, the government says we have the lowest wages on the American flag, which is true. And low wages imply widespread poverty. So we have poverty levels which are much higher than in the US. Right now, it's like 55% of the families or the people live under the official poverty level. Now, high unemployment and widespread poverty also explain another aspect of Puerto Rican society all through the 20th and the 21st century, which is the either significant or mass migration. It's always at least significant. Sometimes it has been truly mass migration, like in the 1950s, or recently between 2010 and 2020. You know, the reasons are obvious. People are poor, people can't find jobs, so they migrate to the United States. Explains why there are so many of us here in the United States. And finally, the fact that we have such a high poverty level implies that many people in Puerto Rico, much more than in the US, are eligible to some sort of welfare or social support programs, which are federally financed. And of course, this is one of the arguments that is always made against Puerto Rican independence. That is to say, we are too poor, we depend on US support to survive, you know, which is kind of ironic because this poverty is a result of colonialism, so the results of colonialism are used to justify colonialism. So anyway, this is very broadly speaking the basic structure of the Puerto Rico's economy under US rule, which, as I said, does not imply that it has remained the same over these, you know, 120 years. It has evolved significantly, materially speaking. For example, agriculture, which used to be our main economic activity, basically doesn't exist anymore. So the economy has transformed, has evolved very strongly, but these elements have remained the same, you know, which characterize our colonial economy. Now,
sorry to interrupt you briefly, Conrad. Sure. I see, fortunately, this room is filling up, and some folks have trickled in. If the people in the front row or in the sides could scoot over.
Yeah.
There's any extra spots so that folks can find us.
And there's a handout for the people who... okay, wonderful. So anyway, moving very rapidly forward to our present situation, what we've had recently, you know, all through the century and our, you know, the 21st century, we have suffered the consequences of Puerto Rico's colonial economy. Now we are also suffering the consequences of the crisis of the colonial economy, because this colonial economy that I just described went into a very deep crisis beginning around 2006. I won't go into the causes of that because it will take too long. We can discuss about it later. But it went into a very deep crisis in 2006, and a very long crisis that can only be described as a depression. A depression that began in 2006 and more or less ended in 2021-22, when the economy began to grow a little bit. Now, what are the features of this crisis that I just mentioned? Well, one of them is, you know, the the way traditionally the economy, the movement of the economy is measured, the movement of the GDP, gross domestic product, it stagnated and it began to fall. The economy of Puerto Rico shrank through these 15 years. It shrank by around 15%. The GDP fell by 15%, which is in any economy is a very, very significant shrinkage. Employment went down. Around 20% of the jobs that existed in 2006, about one-fifth of the jobs that existed in 2006 disappeared at one point or another. That's around 200,000 jobs that vanished. Manufacturing employment, which is very significant because these are the best paying jobs in Puerto Rico, also went down significantly by around 50%. We used to have around 180,000 manufacturing workers, and it went down to about 70,000, you know, in a few years, very significant drop. And as I mentioned, migration as a result of all of this terrible situation accelerated greatly, which meant that for the first time, since they have been keeping censuses in Puerto Rico, the population actually went down. In 2010, Puerto Rico had 3.8 million people, inhabitants in the island. The expectation was that by 2020 it would go up to more than 4 million, but instead it went down to 3.2 million. So the population fell by around 600,000 persons. Now, this very dire economic situation was aggravated by several elements. One of them was Hurricane Maria, which has this was a terrible blow in 2017. The estimated material losses caused by Maria were around $90 billion. The gross domestic product of Puerto Rico in 1 year is $100 million. So it was kind of 1 year of gross domestic product that was destroyed. Then we have a series of earthquakes at the beginning of 2020, which caused significant damage over, above all in the southern part of the island. And then we have the pandemic that, you know, all of us experienced, which also meant a paralysis of the economy for many months. So that's the crisis of the colonial economy that we have been suffering. Now, the as a result of the crisis of the colonial economy, the revenues of the government of Puerto Rico fell significantly, as one may expect. And at that moment, the government of Puerto Rico was at a crossroads. It could, for example, reevaluate its tax policies. Its tax policies basically seek to invite, to attract foreign corporations to invest in Puerto Rico by exempting them from paying taxes, not collecting taxes from these corporations. And the government of Puerto Rico, as its revenue fell, could have reevaluated these tax holiday policies, but it didn't. What it did was it borrowed an increasing amount of money to the point in which 2015, the government was not any longer able to service the debt. So it went into default in 2015. So at that moment, it was evident that the debt of Puerto Rico would have to be renegotiated because the government could not pay the service of the debt. And at that moment, Congress intervened and approved a piece of legislation, which is called the Puerto Rico Oversight, Management, and Economic Stability Act. It's abbreviated as PROMESA, which is kind of cynical because PROMESA means promise in Spanish. And this was adopted in 2016. And as part of the PROMESA legislation, that legislation creates an entity which is called the Federal Oversight and Management Board, which is commonly known in Puerto Rico as the Junta, la Junta de Control Fiscal, you know. And the name is quite appropriate because the Junta, as I indicate in the following page, the junta is sort of a, well, it's not sort of, it's a, an overlord. It's like colonialism squared. The legislature of Puerto Rico, as part of the colonial relationship, lacks many significant powers, you know, which are still in the hands of Congress or the U.S. Government, the federal government. But now we have this board, and this board is empowered. It's seven people named by the President of the United States and Congress. And these seven people, the board, is empowered to oversee the budget of the government of Puerto Rico. That is to say, the government of Puerto Rico has to adopt a what they call a fiscal plan, a five-year fiscal plan. And then that the budget, the yearly budget, has to be adjusted to that fiscal plan. And it is the board that certifies that the budget is indeed, complying with the PROMESA Act, which means that the legislature of Puerto Rico approves a budget, and if the board thinks it's not adequate, then it rejects that budget, and the legislature of Puerto Rico has two options. Either they rewrite, or we rewrite, because I'm in it, the budget according to the demands of the board, or the board, if it's in the end not satisfied with what we have approved, can impose its own budget. So, you know, as I said, the few powers that we had in Puerto Rico within the existing colonial arrangement are now even more limited by the presence of the board.
Sorry to interrupt again, Conrad.
Come on.
I was just going to say, I don't think that filming during sessions is permitted, but there will be an audio recording for posterity. Sorry about that. Saw
okay.
Some phones in the audience.
Okay. So, yeah. So, so needless to say, the board has adopted, you know, functions with what I call the neoliberal diagnosis of Puerto Rico's problems. According to the board, abbreviating this very briefly, but they basically say that the problem with Puerto Rico's budget and Puerto Rico's debt and so on is the fact that the government is too big. The government of Puerto Rico is too big, so Puerto Rico's government has to be reduced, and this is to be done through several means. One of them is privatizing many public agencies and public services, and the other one is reducing public employment, you know, and public the public budget and the amount of public employees. So they have been, by different ways and means, pushing for the privatization of many services and for reducing government employment. You know, the typical neoliberal agenda, nothing particularly creative here. The other element of their analysis is that Puerto Rico's lack of economic growth is due to the fact that, according to them, we have overgenerous labor legislation, you know, which recognizes sick leaves and vacation leaves and pensions and a series of things which have to be eliminated in order for economic growth to, again, take off. So they have been very active also in attacking this legislation. In fact, we think, as bad as the board is, it has even overreached into areas in which we think PROMESA, as bad as it is, did not even grant it the power to go into. I'll give you an example. In 2017, the legislature of Puerto Rico approved legislation very much in line with what the junta wanted, which was to reduce many labor rights in Puerto Rico, you know, some of the things that I mentioned before. And regarding probation periods, vacation periods, and so on and so forth. And back in 2021, we approved legislation to reinstate some of these labor rights that had been eliminated in 2017. Now, bear in mind, this legislation applies to private sector employees, not public employees, private sector. And the junta went to court arguing that this legislation, and won, arguing that this legislation was in contradiction with the fiscal plan that I mentioned before. Now, we argued, you know, the junta doesn't have to get into this. The junta was created to regulate and control the public budget, not relations between private employers and workers in the private sector. But the logic of the junta was, well, what you do in the private sector is going to affect the economy. What affects the economy is going to affect government revenue. What affects government revenue is going to affect, you know, debt payments and so on and so forth. So we can also go into that. And the court bought the argument. So the junta does not simply deal with the public budget and public policies, but has also extended its reach into regulating and vetoing legislation that has to do with the private sector, not the public sector. So, as I say there, you know, they have applied the neoliberal solutions, privatization. Right size the public sector is the euphemism they use to reduce public employment, and the labor counter reform, which is, you know, taking away labor rights. And the other thing that they have done is that, according to PROMESA, the entity that has the right to renegotiate Puerto Rico's debt is not the government of Puerto Rico, it's the board. So we have a situation in which the government of Puerto Rico has a debt, a $73 billion debt, but it's not the government of Puerto Rico who renegotiates the debt. It's the board in the name of Puerto Rico that renegotiates the debt. And the debt has basically three portions: the general obligations of the government of Puerto Rico, the debt of the public corporations like the utilities, the water system, the electric power system, and so on, and the COFINA, which is a particular mechanism I won't go into now. Two of these have already been renegotiated, COFINA and the general obligations, and the one of the public corporations, the main one, which is the electric system, is still in the process of being renegotiated. Back when the crisis erupted in 2015, a study carried out by Stiglitz and a few other economists, not radical or, you know, left-wing, progressive, perhaps liberal, estimated that Puerto Rico's debt had to be reduced by at least 80%, that Puerto Rico could pay 20% of the debt and still be able to provide for, you know, the have the resources necessary to reactivate its economy and so on. The best estimates is that the reduction that we've had so far, it's around 50% of the debt. So we're still paying 50% of the debt, which is much more than what we should be paying. Anyway, needless to say, I won't go into that now. There's a big struggle to audit this debt. It has never been audited, and so on. Anyway, how much time do I have?
You are just about at 30 minutes.
Okay, so let me then...
Oh, sorry, I lied. 20 minutes.
Okay, perfect. So I want to go very rapidly into the political shifts that have happened in Puerto Rico as a result of this situation that I have described. And it's kind of the more optimistic side of what I have just been describing. This is to say, if you have any questions about what's said before, you can ask me. I won't go into more details because I don't have time. Now, fortunately, as you all know, this type of economic crisis can generate many types of reactions in a population. It can bring about the rise and the growth of right-wing, very conservative, very reactionary, xenophobic forces. But it can also, on the other hand, you know, bring about the rise of left-wing progressive forces as a response to the crisis. And I'm glad to report that, until now at least, in Puerto Rico, the consequence of this crisis has been of the second kind. We've had the rise of a right-wing, very conservative, homophobic, traditionalist party, which is called Proyecto Dignidad. It has elected some officials and so on. But what is really significant and interesting of what has happened since 2010 until today is the rise of new progressive left-wing forces and their growing strength and visibility. And I will go very rapidly into some aspects of that. To give you an example, in 2016, there were elections in Puerto Rico, and the new Progressive Party, which is one of the big parties in Puerto Rico, the party that supports turning Puerto Rico into a state of the United States, won with 42% of the vote. Normally, a party in Puerto Rico would win with 49, 50% of the vote. There are two major political parties who basically got all the votes, you know, 97% of the vote, 98% of the vote between the two of them. And there was there is the Independence Party, which would normally get 2%, 3%. But basically, the two big parties control the electoral system. Well, in 2016, there was already a significant indication that this support was falling. Then in 2019, the man who was elected in 2016 was not able to complete his term because people got so tired of his government and the corruption and the inability to have a response to the crisis that I described before, and so many elements went into it. But people went into the street in the summer of 2019 for like 20, 25 days. People were out on the street mobilizing in ever-increasing numbers. We've had the biggest marches in Puerto Rican history. And for the first time, you know, in our history, a governor was forced to step down, you know, as a result of this tremendous mobilization. I'm sure that some of you heard about it at the time. So we had the elections of 2020 after the big mobilizations of 2019. And in the elections of 2020, the PNP won again at the governorship, but with only 33% of the vote. And the other major political party of the Puerto Rican bourgeoisie, as we would say, got 31% of the vote. So the two major parties, which would normally get 98% of the vote, were down to, between the two of them, to 65% of the vote. Means 35% of the people voted for other parties, not the main bourgeois parties. So the, as I said, the fall of the electoral support for these two parties translated into the growth of support for other organizations. We already saw a very significant example of that in the elections of 2016, where there were several individual candidates, people who were running out of party lines as individuals. And between, and one of them, the progressive one, got 16% of the vote, you know, which was a significant number. So in the 2020 elections, it was a very interesting result. There was a new movement, Movimiento Victoria Ciudadana, which I belong to, and it's a movement made up of people who left the Partido Popular, the left wing of the Partido Popular, namely a representative whose name is Manuel Natal, a very well-known young politician in Puerto Rico, who, as I said, was the left wing of the Partido Popular, and he advocated labor rights, he advocated for audit of the Puerto Rico's debt and so on. He left the party. The movement that supported Alexandra Lugaro, who was an independent candidate, the independent candidate that got 16% of the vote in 2016, and the Working People's Party, Partido del Pueblo Trabajador, which I used to be a part of, which is, as the name indicates, a party that identifies with the working class, mainly initiated by socialists. And then when there were other activists from the environmental, feminist, student, labor movement that we all came together to organize the Movimiento Victoria Ciudadana, which participated in the elections in 2020. And then the PIP, who has been a historical party in Puerto Rico, it's not a new party, it's a member of the, officially, it's a member of the Socialist International. It's kind of social democratic, a little bit to the left of what you would normally associate with the Socialist International. And very, you know, positively, in the elections of 2020, Victoria Ciudadana, which was participating for the first time, got 14% of the vote for the governorship. And we elected four legislators, two senators and two representatives. I am one of the senators. And the Partido Independentista Puertorriqueño, which would normally get 2 or 3% of the vote, jumped to 14% of the vote. So the PIP got 14, we got 14. Between the two of us, between the two left-wing parties, we got 28% of the vote. In an election in which the governor or the winner got 33% of the vote. So, you know, it's a new political situation, needless to say. So that was the 2020 elections. The current situation, I'm almost finished, between 2021 and 2024, the present, we've had, the PIP has one senator and one representative. We have two senators and two representatives, so we have three progressives in each house. We have been, you know, pushing and struggling in the legislature for many things. I mentioned some of them here: minimum wage and labor rights, audit of the debt, and an adequate adjustment of the debt. To oppose or revert the privatization policies, approve new environmental protection, women's rights, reproductive rights, LGBTQ rights, and so on. We've had some successes. For example, we succeeded in increasing Puerto Rico's minimum wage. It used to be $7.25, the federal minimum wage. Now it's $10.50. You know, we approved legislation to improve it a certain amount every year, right? And the last increase was just went into effect in June, and. So we are, and we also, there was a big feeling within progressive sectors in Puerto Rico, even beyond that, that it would be terrible if the PIP and the MVC, our two parties, went to the elections of 2024 separately, therefore in competition with each other. There was a big pressure that we should forge some sort of alliance, which we have. So in the elections next November, the PIP and the MVC are going together as part of an alliance. And in order to do that, we've had to work our way around the present electoral legislation in Puerto Rico, which used to allow for a candidate to appear in the column of two parties, which makes coalitions, you know, very simple. You would have the same guy for governor, for example, in the list of the PIP and in the list of the MVC. And whether you voted for the PIP or the MVC, you voted for the same guy for governor because we are running together. And but needless to say, the PIP, our enemies, made sure that that which had existed for the longest time doesn't exist anymore. So we have to work around this. And the way it basically works is that the PIP, for example, we agreed that we would support the PIP's candidate for governor. So the PIP has a candidate for governor, and we have a candidate for governor, but because the law forces us to have a candidate for governor in order to compete in the election, but that candidate isn't really running. You know, that candidate is saying you vote for, but for the other guy, you know. And the same, for example, in San Juan, for the mayor's office in San Juan, we have the candidate, the MVC, Manuel Natal. He's running for mayor. He already ran in 2020 and lost by like 1,000 votes. So, you know, we think he won, but he just stole it. But anyway, even if he lost by a very small margin. So he's now running, and the PIP doesn't have a candidate for mayor. So everybody's supposed to vote for Natal. And, you know, it works that way all around the island. I won't go into all the details. Now, right now, the Alianza is very well placed. All the polls that we've seen recently say that place us second. They place the candidate of the PMP first with 35% or something like that of the intention to vote. They place La Alianza second with around 27 or 28%. And the PPD, the other major party, much lower, like 14%. So even if that were to come true, even if we were to come in second, you know, it's like in the U.S., the Republicans winning the election, but, the Green Party or the, you know, some other third party formation would come in second, and the Democrats would be, you know, in third place. So it's a very interesting situation. Now, the right wing, needless to say, ever since the results of 2020, have been very worried about the strengthening of the left in Puerto Rico, and they have not been inactive at all. One of the things that they have done is that they have, traditionally, Puerto Rican employers and the Puerto Rican bourgeoisie has been confident that the PPD and the PMP can represent their interests, you know, adequately. Yeah. And three more minutes and I finish. And but now they have felt compelled to create a super PAC in order to do that more directly. So they have put millions of dollars into this super PAC, $3 or $4 million they seem to have, in order to campaign basically against La Alianza, you know. And the campaign, as I said, I say in the bottom, is a major disinformation campaign. The main aspect of it is that this is communism. You know, this is a communist conspiracy. This is Maduro, and this is Cuba, and you know, and whatnot. And Bernabe is a communist and a socialist. It's true, but you know, but sometimes they're correct, and so on and so forth. But you know, this fear mongering, you know, that you know you are familiar with, I'm sure. I'll give you a funny example of that in a minute to conclude. They have, as I said, they put legal obstacles in the way of the Alianza, which I already mentioned, that they made it, we have to make it a de facto alliance because legally speaking, it doesn't really show up in the ballot. And one of the things that they have done is through some legal shenanigans, the particulars of which I won't go into now unless you want to, they were able to remove some of the candidates of the Alianza and of the MBC from the ballot, myself included. There are two incumbents, people, you know, who are in office right now, Mariana Nogales, who's a representative, and me, who are not going to be in the ballot. People have to vote for us, you know, right in. So, you know, it makes it significantly more difficult. So they are doing everything they can to stop the Alianza from growing. I think I'm going to leave it there. The funny anecdote I wanted to give you to conclude is that as part of that anti-communist campaign they are conducting in Puerto Rico, somebody in their think tanks got hold of the program of the Socialism Conference, and some of the activities are going to be, you know, participating in here. We have a fundraiser later tonight at 9 o'clock. I will tell you about it in a minute. And so they published this all over the place. You know, this is the most famous talk I've ever given in my life, because all over the right-wing press in Puerto Rico is Bernabe is going to the U.S. to meet with the Marxists in Chicago and so on and so forth, and they put photographs of the talk I'm giving and so on and so forth, you know, because they want to get hold of anything that they can use to demonstrate, you know, that this is a Marxist conspiracy that is threatening Puerto Rico in 2024. So I leave it at that, and I had a few things about at the end about what program we need, what the U.S. left could do, and so on. But you know, we can talk about it in the discussion period if you wish.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.